This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
At least one protester was shot dead and 20 more were wounded Monday in the Kenyan city of Kisumu as Kenya's opposition resumed its weekly protests against the country's electoral commission. Demonstrations took place in six cities overall.
That's VOA correspondent Jill Craig in Nairobi. Details coming up.
Also, Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mahamud visited the giant Dadaab refugee camp complex in Kenya today. And food shortages are growing worse in Malawi as the yield from this year's disappointing harvest runs out for many small farmers.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, at least one protester was shot dead and 20 more were wounded today in the Kenyan city of Kismuyu as opposition protesters resumed their weekly demonstrations against the country's electoral commission. Demonstrations took place in six cities overall. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
The demonstration in Kisumu descended into police gunfire and burning tires. In the capital, Nairobi, a more peaceful protest took place. Hundreds of opposition supporters marched to the headquarters of the Electoral Commission, known as the IEBC. They waved tree branches and held signs that read, "Kenyans don't trust IEBC." Kenya's High Court this morning declined to block the planned protests. The judge also ordered the police to provide security for the demonstrators. James Orengo, a senator from Siaya County and a CORD leader, welcomed the news.
The order that has been made by a judge of the High Court today is a great victory for the country. There was a habit that was beginning to emerge where certain elements in government were trying to use the courts in order to sanitize their activities.
Riot police were noticeably absent from the streets of Nairobi, though about a dozen were deployed inside the IEBC compound. Unlike previous weeks, tear gas and water cans were not deployed Monday in Nairobi to disperse protesters. Eric Ndalo is a Nairobi-based businessman who came to the protests because of what he called his national duty.
It is important to have a credible electoral board in place so that the elections will be free and fair.
The CORD opposition coalition is demanding electoral reforms ahead of the 2017 national polls, including the dissolution of the nine-member IEBC board, which the opposition says is biased in favor of the ruling Jubilee coalition. CORD wants the commission replaced with a new five-member board. The near-weekly protests began in April, and Kenyans have taken to calling them Machozi Monday for the tear gas used by police. Three people were killed in western Kenya during the last round of demonstrations, May 23rd. Photos and videos of police beating protesters have sparked public outcry. Attempts last week to organize talks between the opposition and the government failed. The opposition says it will continue the weekly protests until its demands are met. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mahamud visited the giant Dadaab refugee camp complex in Kenya today. The visit follows Kenya's recent announcement that it intends to close the camp where hundreds of thousands of people live. The Somali leader said that his country, Kenya, and the UN Refugee Agency have never discussed or agreed upon a quick return for the refugees. Many living at Dadaab were born there and have never been to Somalia. President Mahamud thanked Kenya for hosting a large number of Somalis. He told those at Dadaab that Kenya's decision reflects a revival of Somalia's peace, adding they could make a difference when they return home.
The Prime Minister of Libya's new government of national accord is predicting total victory against ISIS forces in the eastern coastal city of Sirte. Fayez al-Sarraj says militias supporting his UN-backed government have retaken Gardabia, an airbase 30 kilometers from Sirte. Militia from Misrata were reported attacking the western outskirts of Sirte late last week. A second force of petroleum facility guards is reported to have taken two ISIS-controlled towns east of Sirte.
Food shortages are growing worse in Malawi as the yield from the year's disappointing harvest runs out for many small farmers. Across southern Africa, El Niño-induced drought and flooding since last year have left over 30 million people in need of food aid. Lamek Masina reports from Balaka in southeastern Malawi.
In Balaka, 47% of residents are facing food shortages. That is the highest figure of all the affected districts across the country. Many people here are down to one meal a day. Anima Tebule is a single mother of four children. She says because of the drought, she only managed to harvest only 150-kilogram bag of maize this year. She usually harvests 25 bags. She says she relies on doing gardening and other odd jobs to feed her children. She says my children are suffering. She says we usually eat once a day. We can eat twice a day only when I am given sweet potatoes as payment for doing some day labor. Thomas Bisig is a health officer in the district. He told VOA the number of malnourished children has quadrupled.
The levels of malnutrition in Balaka are a bit alarming as compared to last year, the very same period, because last year we had about 12%, but this year it's about 52%, which means that as we are scaling up to March next year, the situation will be a bit out of our control.
The effects of child malnutrition can last a lifetime. They can lead to stunting and developmental delays and even impact on a child's future learning potential. The UN World Food Programme is funding supplemental feeding programs at all 13 health centers in Balaka district. The beneficiaries receive 4.5 kilograms of corn soya blend every 2 weeks. Chris Nkwamba says she started getting soya flour for her 2-year-old daughter because she was underweight. She says now I can see some improvements. She says her daughter has gained 1 kilo and now weighs 6 kilograms. WFP country director Koko Ushiama says the agency is also encouraging farmers in Balaka to diversify their crops.
When they can get a message across that it's not just maize that's food, there's other nutritious foods that people can eat. These are areas that we can have a big momentum to move forward.
Malawi declared a national disaster in April. The price of maize and other foods has since tripled at the market. Malawi's government says 8.4 million people, about half the population, need food aid. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Balaka, Malawi.
A senior UN official is warning that a growing sense of global inequality accompanied by low productivity gains and wages is stifling resistance to international trade. The comment came in the lead-up to the 14th session of the UN Conference on Trade and Development next month in Nairobi. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UNCTAD's Secretary General Mukisa Kituyi says the gloss is rubbing off the growing optimism of recent years that Africa was rising while Asia retained its position as an economic powerhouse and other regions were benefiting from a general uptick in the global economy. He says these regions now are largely beset by stagnation as economies slow down. He says low employment and rising debt are leading to the most rapid expansion of economic migrants from sub-Saharan Africa in 70 years.
In the developed world, we're seeing a number of things. One, the growing unpopularity of international trade. Particularly, you see all the major parties in the U.S. Are rejectionists of internationalism. The challenges of slow growth are also leading to some forms of phobia. You see the anxiety in Europe about immigrants from the Middle East and Sub-Saharan Africa.
Kitui says the Doha trade talks, which began under the umbrella of the World Trade Organization in 2001, remain stuck. He says there is declining optimism that problems such as domestic agricultural subsidies can be sorted out through the multilateral process. He says UNCTAD 14 cannot attempt to make progress on the Doha talks problems as they remain under the purview of WTO.
But we come back to the reality that we can raise the question of how can we breathe new fresh air in the development side of international trade? How can we revive international trade as a positive force for inclusive prosperity, for new opportunities for others, for greater access to quality products at competitive pricing internationally? How can we push back the sense that international trade is about robbing rich countries of their own markets and their labor opportunities?
UNCTAD Secretary General Kitui says these are legitimate questions for discourse. He says the Nairobi talks offer the opportunity to address these and other difficult and controversial issues without the passion and impassioned politics surrounding the matter in some countries today. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's 17 past the hour. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. More than 1,800 people were evacuated from a makeshift tent camp in Paris today after heavy rains this month caused living conditions to deteriorate. AFP reports the migrants, mostly Afghans, Sudanese, and Eritreans, were transported to 60 different reception centers in the Paris area. This is the second time the camp has been evacuated. A similar operation was carried out last month. French officials say makeshift camps are becoming common as the migrant and refugee flow to Europe grows.
A new report shows that climate change is fast becoming one of the most significant risks for World Heritage sites. The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, along with other scientific organizations, participated in the study. It lists 31 natural and cultural sites in 29 countries that are vulnerable to increasing temperatures, melting glaciers, rising sea levels, droughts, and other weather phenomena. The report documents the impact of climate on iconic tourism sites. Among them are South Africa's Cape Floral Kingdom and Uganda's Bwindi Impenetrable National Park, where the mountain gorilla's habitat is at risk. Adam Markham is lead author of the study and is deputy director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He spoke with me about the urgent need for scientists to better understand, monitor, and address climate change threats to World Heritage sites.
We looked at 31 sites in 29 countries around the world, and it ranges everything from the tropical forests that contain some of the last mountain gorillas in Uganda to the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor. We looked at coral reefs in the Pacific, the statues of Easter Island, and archaeological sites in Greenland and the UK.
And how are these sites being threatened by climate change?
Well, it's quite amazing the range of types of impacts that we can see. So the most obvious one that most people know about is sea level rise causing more flooding, more intense storms causing extreme weather events, rainfall, flooding, and erosion, but also melting glaciers, thawing permafrost, worse wildfires. That's particularly something that's affecting Yellowstone in the western United States, for example.
What can countries such as, for instance, developing countries like Uganda, what can they do to help protect mountain gorillas who are at risk there?
Well, mountain gorillas are already at risk from human encroachment, population growth around the national parks. There are poaching problems. There's problems with mining and resource extraction. So climate change kind of comes on top of all that. So it makes existing stresses worse. So a country like Uganda is going to have probably international help to try to protect those resources. And so international aid agencies and Western governments should be helping to bring more resources so that the park rangers can be trained and so that they can be just more ability to be more resilient to this change.
How do these sites fit into the goal of the climate agreement that was negotiated in Paris, or were they even mentioned there?
This specific problem wasn't addressed at the Paris Agreement, but I think what clearly came from Paris is that the governments acknowledged that we need to keep temperatures down below 2, even to 1.5 degrees centigrade. And what this report shows is that we have every reason to do that very quickly because of the threat to World Heritage.
Do you think the international community is really going to respond to this in an urgent way?
The issue of World Heritage touches people's hearts. They know these places. Many people have visited them, whether they're national parks in the U.S. or coral reefs in Australia and the Pacific. I think that people will demand more action when they realize how bad the problem is.
Tourism was part of this report that you all did. So what effect does tourism have on World Heritage sites?
Tourism is really a double-edged sword. It can be very, very positive in that it brings tourists with income and revenue to places. So Yellowstone National Park, for example, the revenue there supports about 7,000 jobs in the region. The islands of Galapagos and Easter Island, their economies are almost 100% dependent on tourism. But the other side of the coin is that too many tourists, or tourism that isn't managed, too many developments on the coast, building too many hotels, can cause direct damage to these very sensitive sites. So it's something that has to be managed very carefully.
What then needs to be done on a universal level?
Well, the World Heritage Convention is an international convention, and it's organized around the World Heritage Committee. So we hope that that committee, which next meets in Istanbul, Turkey, in July, will look at this report and begin to develop new policies which help the governments that are parties to the convention address the issue of climate change. It hasn't yet been sufficiently addressed by the World Heritage Committee.
And do you think this will be brought up at the next climate conference coming up in November?
Yes, I think it's very likely there'll be a series of side events. We'll probably be involved in some of those, as will UNEP and UNESCO, to try and draw attention to the effects on World Heritage sites. And I think because the meeting is going to be in Morocco, we're going to be looking at particularly at drier countries and the issue of climate change and water.
That was Adam Markham, Deputy Director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He spoke with me from Wilson, Connecticut.
According to U.S. government figures, hundreds of millions of people visited America's state and national parks last year. But research at the University of Missouri indicates that African Americans are significantly less likely to tour the recreational and natural wonders at those sites. To find out why, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Konje Lee, who oversaw research that focused on one Texas state park in particular.
If you look at the park visitation patterns in the United States, majority of park visitors are white Americans. African Americans constitute only a small portion of the total visitors of those parks. Previously, many studies talk about different reasons, such as cultural factors, discriminations, and prejudice at the park. If we wanted to talk about African-American culture that doesn't appreciate parks or natural environment, we need to understand the root of that culture. That was one of the biggest reasons why I conducted this research. I strongly believe this is the outcome of historical racial oppression in the United States. If you look at the U.S. history, African Americans are treated as second-class citizens. African Americans are not able to visit many recreational places, including national parks, and state parks, or maybe even community parks, because of Jim Crow's and segregation and racism practices.
You mean this was up until the last half century or so, but not now?
Exactly. But we need to understand how the centuries of racial oppressions created specific dispositions among people. So, for example, the people that I interview with, African Americans, those individuals' parents, grandparents, and grandparents, those individuals are not able to visit these recreational places because if they do, in the worst case scenario, they can get killed. And it sort of shaped as a specific disposition within African American community. So even though today's African Americans do not experience any type of segregation or racial discriminations at the parks, their family members were not able to cultivate this culture that appreciate parks or outdoor recreation environments.
So tell me, just in a nutshell, what was your study? I mean, then you can say what you think is generalizable about it. I mean, what did you do? You went to this one Texas state park, right?
So the reason why I conducted this study at this specific park at Cedar Hill State Park in Texas was because the park was located right next to large middle-class African-American communities. I interviewed about 15 African-Americans, and I visited their local libraries to review their local newspapers. And I also conducted a site visit, field trip to the specific parks about three times. And my conclusion is that a lot of African-American interviewees, they feel uncomfortable visiting this park because they routinely experience racial discriminations in their daily lives, and the negative perception was spilled over to the specific park.
It was also on the site of a plantation where slaves were once owned, right?
Exactly. And that the history of the slavery was not presented at the park when I was conducting the research, as if slavery didn't exist in that specific place at all.
So some of these people who lived near the park, these African Americans, actually told you that they felt insecure in these parks, that they didn't feel safe?
Yes, they did.
Tell me a little bit about what you suggest as a solution or as a way to kind of reverse this reality so that African Americans can enjoy and feel comfortable visiting these parks like anyone else.
I think what is really important here is that we need to make sure that the younger generations of African Americans understand the value of parks and outdoor environment. Visiting parks and great outdoors provide numerous health and social benefits. So it's unfortunate that these individuals can't take advantage of these public resources because these places are managed by tax dollars. So in a nutshell, their tax dollar is not spent for themselves. They are their tax dollars are spent to someone else, usually white visitors. And I think some of the strategies might be reaching out to local schools and invite kids to parks as a field trip or maybe picnic days or some kind of events so they can experience parks a little bit. So in terms of social equality and social justice, this is a very serious issue.
That was Kanye Lee at the University of Missouri. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Keith Holmes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa.
VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou, Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.